Hi, friends. It's Susan Blackwell from The Spark File, your one-stop shop for creativity where our doors are open. And if you smell something delicious, that's because Laura Camion and I have been cooking up something special, something designed to make a big difference in people's creative lives. Enter The Brave Creative, a free 5-day guided adventure to rediscover the vitality, energy, and possibility in your creative process. Whether you're a writer, a performer, a baker, a candlestick maker, navigating the creative process can be a bear. But never fear, there's power in numbers at The Spark File. So let's link arms and make the trip together. It's May 13th through 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern, less than 1 hour per day. And if you can't join live, don't worry about it. You can watch the replay. Join us by going to thesparkfile.com to register. And hey, if you're not familiar with The Spark File, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Secondly, we work with hundreds of creatives of all different kinds who are ready to take their next big step. We help folks fear less and create more in a community that is so fun and vibrant. And if you have joined us before, know that we are going deep with The Brave Creative. So buckle up, Buttercup. It is going to be an awesome adventure. Go to thesparkfile.com to register, but do it soon because it all starts May 13th. Thesparkfile.com. Register now. Hello, Metropolitan Opera lovers. Welcome to the Spark File podcast. This episode was recorded live at the Met featuring Anthony Roth Costanzo, star of the Metropolitan Opera's Akhenaten. If you enjoy creative conversations like this one, we hope you'll subscribe to the Spark File podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Spark File podcast may contain profanity and other adult content. Please use your discretion.
Inspires me. I dump it in my spark file.
Spark file.
Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file.
Spark file.
I jump into my spark file.
Spark file.
Let's open up the spark file.
Welcome to The Spark File, your one-stop podcast for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome.
Welcome.
You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are good questions, people, and we have got answers.
Yes, we do. A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
Here's the deal. We are makers who make all kinds of things.
If you're anything like us and you're making stuff all the time, or you want to be making stuff all the time, you already know that the wellspring of inspiration can sometimes run a little dry.
So we are on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this very podcast.
Yes. Or perhaps make a castle that brings your wildest imaginings to life.
Interesting. Or an opera that gives you a reason for living. Suck on that.
Wow.
Top it. Top it, Camion. Top it.
Can't top it. Every episode, we're going to reach into our spark files and exchange some sparks. And today, we're also going to talk to someone who truly sparks us.
And if you're not careful, you might just get your creative pipe snaked. So without further ado, let's open up
the spark file.
Isn't that classy?
That was good.
That was classy.
I wanted to do a super classy one because we're at the Metropolitan Opera House.
Goal accomplished,
exactly.
Blackwell.
Cams.
Babe.
We're at the Met.
We are. It's so thrilling. I was thrilled just knowing it was going to happen, but now it's happening. I'm like beyond.
It's happening right now.
I don't even know what to do with myself.
I know. I feel like I won a contest.
It's super, super exciting.
Yeah.
And also it's exciting that we're doing something a tiny bit different with this episode.
That's right.
Normally we have two episodes a week, one where we share sparks and one where we talk to a maker. Today, it's all in one.
It's a combo platter, baby. We got two Love sparks it. With a healthy side of Maker. It's going to be great. but we have so much ground to cover, as baby cams would say. I call this is my little baby cam cams.
That's right.
As little baby it's cams stuck. Would say, we have got 15 pounds of spark in a 10-pound bag, so we better get to sparking. Oh, cams, I think you're going first.
I am going first.
I will tell you this. This podcast is really the great joy of my life. I mean, I love my husband very much as well, but podcast.
Nathan, you're great too. You're
and
great
one too. Of the things I love so much about it is it's like every episode, because you're about to surprise me with this spark.
That's right.
Every episode is like giving a gift and getting a gift. And so I'm going to sit back. I'm going to chilly chill and I'm just going to receive my gift.
That's right. Receive this.
I can't wait.
Susan, Richard Wagner said, that's right.
You went jumping right in. Straight classical.
Right in.
Go ahead.
It is not willpower, but fantasy and imagination that creates. Imagination is the creative force. Imagination creates reality. Boom.
Get it, Wagner.
That's right. There is a man born more than 150 years ago whose imagination was not only his personal respite, his personal salvation in a way, but his imagination was so powerful it created a legacy that we are living, that we get to enjoy in our lives today.
Tell me more.
I will. His titles include Count Palatine of the Rhine.
Wait a minute, Wagner?
No. This is the man I'm
talking
about.
That's right. Get it.
That's right.
You're about to intro somebody.
That's right. No, I am introing.
It's happening.
Someone. We're in the middle of
we're
it,
in
actually.
It.
Like, this right now is an introduction.
Wait, is this a spark?
It is.
I'm going to stop interrupting you then.
No, but why? But why stop? It's more fun that
Wait,
way.
Wait, do it. So start fresh. Yeah. Okay, here we go. It just sounds like you're about.
No, wait, is this the introduction?
It sounds like you're about like a WWF, like wrestler.
Ooh, we could do it that way.
That's what it sounds like.
The Count of Palatine of the Rhine. Yes, it
also
is.
Also known as, yes.
The Duke of Franconia.
Really?
The Duke in Swabia. Yes.
Okay.
He's got a lot. He's sometimes called the Dream King, sometimes called the Fairy Tale King.
Pause. I uh-huh. want everyone from this point forward to call me the Dream King.
You can't have it. The title's taken.
God damn it.
Although, okay, let me tell you about him, and if you think you can top him, then we can discuss maybe you could be the Dream King. He's also called the Fairy Tale King, the Swan King, or more frequently, the Mad King.
Ooh.
He once declared, "I want to remain an eternal enigma to myself and to the world." He is King Ludwig II of Bavaria. That's right.
That's what he
is right there. He's kind of a cutie.
He doesn't look like WWF, though.
No, he doesn't. And far too sensitive to be a wrestler, I'll say, but we'll get to that. So he ruled Bavaria from 1860.
Is it Bavaria or Bavaria? You say Bavaria, I say Bavaria.
That's right.
Okay.
It's a little of that. I'm from Kansas. I don't know. Bavaria.
Does anybody in the audience know?
Bavaria, Bavaria.
Bavaria.
Air, Bavaria.
Bavaria. I only know that because I like their pretzels.
Bavarian pretzels?
Why are you looking at me like I'm insane?
Well, you might be the Mad King.
you got Bavarian. A bad case of Mad King. I'm sorry,
Bavarian
go ahead.
Bavaria, yeah. Pretzels.
Yeah, there you go.
I wish I could tie that in and say that he was also responsible for Bavarian
Just
pretzels.
Say it. We're not journalists. We're
hey,
not academics. Just
King
say it.
Ludwig, he's all over it. All right. So he is one of the most legendary figures in Bavarian and German history. And if you think about it, they already have quite a few legendary figures. So,
word.
So he's up there. In a New York Times article in 1995, Julius Desing, who at that time had been a member of the loosely organized Ludwig cult for about 30 years. He says, Ludwig sparks the imagination of people around the world. Young people admire him because he insisted on going his own way rather than playing the role that had been set out for him. older people are fascinated with the whole tragic mystery of his life and death. There's so much good stuff in his story. It's going to be an abbreviated version today, but I think we're really primed and ready for a new flurry of Ludwig cult members. I really do. I think they're ready for an influx of new members, and I'll be one. I might join.
What do you think your uniforms are going to be? Like your cult?
Oh, right there. Right there.
I like You'll this say, look yeah, for you, a red sash, a knee-high boot. I like it.
And if you're listening and you can't see that image, it'll be on our Instagram, I think.
Follow us at The Spark File.
The Spark File. So little Ludwig was born in 1845, and right from the start, we have lies and we have secrecy, which I just love this stuff. So he was born around, like, just before midnight on August 24th, but they kept the whole thing secret so they could lie and say that he was born on August 25th, which is also the birthday of his grandfather, King Ludwig I.
Got it. Okay.
And they originally named him Otto, but for some reason, like 2 weeks later, they're like, actually, no. I think we'll go with Ludwig.
Really?
Yeah, we'll go with Ludwig. Okay. So they switch it again. And I just think it seems like an awful lot of like, hey, let's make this connection to grandpa.
Got it. Okay.
And then I read that there's numerous rumors that his father was not his real father. Oh. So perhaps his mom was looking out to make this connection, right?
Jerry.
So I think mom was looking out for the security of the lineage there. And like the stronger we can make this tie with grandpa, the better off we're going to be.
I knew it was going to be some marketing spin. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's a PR spin right there. His parents weren't particularly interested in him or his brother, and they weren't particularly interested in each other. So it was notoriously quiet in the house.
Mm.
Or in the castle, I guess. It's a notoriously quiet castle. And no one really talked to each other. So Ludwig retreated into this whole fantasy world of his own imagination. He was a very expressive and creative little boy. He was artistic and sensitive. And this castle that he grew up in was filled with images of German mythology. There were frescoes that depicted characters from the Ring of the Nibelungs.
Girl, why are you looking at me for pronunciation of the Nibelungs?
Because of Bavaria. Now I'm going to look to you. Right. Bavaria. That's what I said. Bavaria, right?
We'll take that out
in post. I'm going to look to you for all of it. So he, like, this castle was just filled with these images. Charlemagne.
Yes, check. Mm-hmm. Charlemagne.
Thank you, check.
That
sounded
great.
Dietrich von Bern.
Sure.
Check. And his favorite, Lohengrin.
Thank you.
Oh. Lohengrin. Great. So when Ludwig was 12 years old, Wagner's Lohengrin was showing in Munich, and he begged his father to let him go, like begged him.
I'm sorry. Is Lohengrin an opera?
It is.
I didn't know.
Oh, I'm so excited that you didn't know that. That's exciting.
Girl, and you could fill books with what I don't know. So, okay, great.
We'll start here. Great. So it was one of Wagner's operas, and he knew that, and it's filled with all these same characters that surrounded him as a child.
So he was super psyched
I really
to
see that.
Lohengrin.
That's right.
Lohengrin? Okay,
Lohengrin.
Okay, I'm with you.
But dad, remember, like, they had nothing in common. His dad was, like, so not into him, and he's like, you can't go.
Yeah.
But he pestered him and begged him for 3 more years. That's right. Circled around. Eventually, 3 years later, when he was 15, he was allowed to see the opera. And once he did, his life was changed like forevermore. There was no going back after that. Like, he lost himself. He almost lost his mind watching this opera. It was like his whole like imaginary world was brought to life. People recorded that he was weeping, and it was a very, very big deal for him. After the show, he just threw himself into anything he could get his hands on related to Wagner, articles, essays, pamphlets, librettos. He even read the preface to Wagner's not yet produced Ring Cycle. So he read this preface, and in that preface, Wagner rhetorically asks, like, hey, maybe someday, who knows, there'll be a prince who has the means and the resources and the authority to bring this work to stage. Wouldn't that be crazy?
Whoa.
And here's our 15-year-old Ludwig It's a few years away, but he eventually becomes that prince who emerges to make that a reality, which is pretty awesome.
That's amazing.
It's pretty cool. But before that could happen, Ludwig's life changed completely. When he was 18 years old, his dad got sick suddenly and he died. Like, literally, he was sick for 3 days and he died.
Oh, shit.
Unexpected, Ludwig was thrust into the role of the king, not particularly prepared and, frankly, not particularly interested in being the king.
18 years old?
18 years old.
But guess what you can do when you're the king?
What?
Anything you fucking want.
Well, Blackwell, it is funny that you say that. Because we're going to circle back to that. I don't know that that's
really
true. Oh,
except for all the things you don't want to do.
Except for what you can't do. But
yeah,
we'll get to
you're
that.
Right, you're right. Okay.
But the really, really cool thing is, and one of the things that completely sparked me, is that the very first thing he did as king was establish a new court theater.
Can we talk
about that for a second? Like, I have a fantasy. Like what leader could be elected? And they're like, the very first thing I want to do is just give the arts what they need. Like, let us contend with our collective emotional needs first and foremost. Like, that's really, really exciting. Yeah. So he dug into it. Some people thought he was crazy for it, but he didn't care.
Mad King. There you go.
He didn't care. So he starts with the arts, but unfortunately, almost immediately, he's still 18, the country has to go to war against Prussia. They lose, a very quick but very painful loss. And after Prussia wins, Bavaria is now part of the new German Empire. Okay?
Yeah.
So he's still king of Bavaria, but they're a little less, like, he doesn't actually have final say in a lot of things because they're part of this greater empire. So we'll get back to that in a minute. But he was devastated by the loss, but at least after the war, he could get back to what he really wanted to do, which was throw himself into these extravagant artistic and architectural projects that would literally bring his imagination to life.
So was he like a producer in a way? Or,
well,
was he an artist himself?
Yes, okay. He was in some ways. But he also was a supporter of the art. So one of the first things he did was summon Richard Wagner to his court.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because he had been obsessed.
He had been obsessed.
Yeah.
And, oh, I have a slide. I'm so glad I remembered that.
Who dat?
Richard Wagner.
I don't fucking know. I'm learning. I never knew that's what
so
he looked like.
The thing is, he summons Wagner.
Dude is giving me light Abraham Lincoln vibes.
A little bit.
All right.
Yeah. So Wagner wasn't especially easy to find at that time because he had a reputation as a philanderer, a political radical, which is putting it kindly. And he was almost always on the run from creditors. And at that particular time, he was living in exile, literally hiding from the people that he owed money to.
Really?
That is right. That
he
is right.
He ran up that credit card and he was like, my.
Yeah. And remember that at this time you could go to jail for debt.
Wow.
So, like, it was no joke.
So he's a hard man to track down.
But the king's people found him, and they brought him to the court. They talked for an hour and a half. Fell in love is probably, I don't know, speculation. But they were fond of each other after that hour and a half. And I'll tell you more about that, too. So later, Wagner wrote about the king and his first meeting with Ludwig. Quote, alas, he is so handsome and wise, soulful and lovely, that I fear that his life must melt away in this vulgar world like a fleeting dream of the gods. It's a bit of a prophecy,
My funny Valentine.
Wagner.
That is hot.
So after the meeting, they begin this long friendship. It's somewhat a complicated relationship, which we'll get into, but a long friendship nonetheless. And Ludwig decides to sponsor him. Essentially, he puts him up with a home. He gives him a stipend. Like, Wagner never has to worry about paying these debts or being, you know, in trouble again.
Amazing.
And he can focus just on writing. At first, Ludwig housed him close to him, like in the capital city. But Wagner's behavior was so extravagant and scandalous that the conservative people of Bavaria didn't take so kindly to it.
Oh, no.
So the king was pressured to ask Wagner to leave the city only 6 months later.
What was he doing?
That's another story for another day. But instead, Ludwig provided a beautiful home for Wagner in Switzerland, right by Lake Lucerne, which, name drop, if you've never been there, it is one of the most beautiful places in the whole world.
Did you
I would
go
suggest
there?
You go.
When did you go there?
That's also another long story. I'm looking at the top.
I'm sorry.
But I did. And went to Lake Lugano in Switzerland. That whole area is literally like the most gorgeous. But so there's Wagner, nice and comfortable, riding away up in his beautiful home. When Ludwig was forced to move him out of the city, he was so upset about it, he considered abdicating his throne in order to follow Wagner to Lake Lucerne.
I smell love.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right. But Wagner persuaded him to stay on the throne. I think he knew it might be a little bit more beneficial for
He's
him.
Like, stay on the throne,
for
babe.
You got
stay
this.
On the throne.
Stay there. Yeah. Stay there. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to need you. We're going to need you. But this is a really interesting side bit here. So there are those people who believe that the two of them may have had more than a friendship. But Wagner's like escapades with women are well documented. This crazy on and off with his wife, his first wife.
You can have it all.
You can have it all.
Yeah.
You can. There's no record of it, though. But people speculate, nonetheless. Okay. But King Ludwig was very likely gay. He never married. He was engaged to his cousin, but he called it off. There's not a single record of him ever having a relationship with a woman. But on the other hand, there are records of him being very, very close to his male entourage.
Okay.
What I found really interesting and sparkish was this fact and looking at it through this lens. Remember I told you that they lost that war when he was 18 and became part of the German Empire. Prior to that, homosexuality in Bavaria was legal.
Mm.
So he grew up, and as his sexuality emerged, it was legal. He becomes king. They lose this war. Now homosexuality is illegal in all of the German Empire.
Yeah.
So just looking at it through that lens, like, what did that do to his feeling of like powerlessness? To be like, I am in charge, but I can't affect change for the laws that affect me deeply and personally.
Yeah.
I don't know that he ever really, really got over that, but I think there's a really interesting story there, and I think that it would be so great for someone to tell. Like, his story has been told many ways in different ways, but I don't know that anyone's ever told the story that way and really looked at it, at the impact of that, and I think it would be interesting. So if you're listening and that sparks you in any way, please take it and make it.
That could be so
please
many things.
Please go tell
things.
That story.
Novel,
we need it.
Movie.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good.
And the most exciting thing is that despite the laws of the land, despite the laws of the church, by every indication, Ludwig lived his life authentically as himself as much as he could. So I think that's very inspiring to people. So some people believe that he and Wagner were lovers, but there's no lasting proof of that. One thing that they certainly shared was a passion for the work, and they were both obsessed with the desire to keep the focus on the work.
Mm.
They together, I think, ushered in a new era of theater going, an era that we still enjoy in our modern theaters today. They transformed the theater going experience, making it less about seeing and being seen.
Oh.
And making it more about
the experience of
the art storytelling and the art
Interesting.
Form. One of the biggest ways they did that, there's a whole story here, but they did that by building the ideal opera house, the Bayreuth.
How do we do?
Bayreuth? The festival hall, which is what I'll refer to it from now on. The festival hall to house the Wagner's Ring Cycle. And he imagined it at first that they were going to build this whole thing, do the Ring Cycle, and then tear it down. But they did not tear it down.
Wow.
Thankfully. But the theater is remarkable, and it's revolutionary in many ways. The seating. Oh, this is an image of it from the outside. But inside, the seating was intended to be entirely democratic. There are no boxes and no special seating for important people. By the standards of the day, it's quite unornamental. It may not look like that to us, but compared to the other the other opera houses of the day, it was pretty clean. The orchestra pit is entirely concealed from view. Wagner wanted to make sure that even the orchestra was not a distraction from the story that he was telling and the work that he was doing. And to further assist with focus, this theater was the first ever to present the operas with the house lights entirely turned off, which was innovative at the time.
Wow.
It was amazing.
So it was these dudes.
It was these dudes.
Thanks, dudes.
Thank you. So the audience could sit in the dark and not be distracted by, like, you know, their neighbors and who's wearing what and
glittering,
you know,
diamonds.
Your friends.
Yes, all of
exactly.
It. Yeah.
So together they created theatrical traditions that we take for granted, I think, now, and we still continue to enjoy. But throughout his life, Ludwig was not only a patron of the arts, but he was a creative being himself. He gave life to his imagination in many, many ways, one of which was building castles, which is a really fun habit to have and a hobby, like, hey, let's build a few castles.
If you got the budget,
lifetime.
Build yourself a castle.
That's right. So he built some of the most famous Bavarian castles, many of which are the biggest tourist attractions today. They're extravagant, they're over the top, and each are unique. I'm going to do this super fast. There are castles that have grottos. You can take a gondola to the stage.
This is a very Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom of the Opera. This little cave-like space, beautifully lit, and of course designed for what?
Opera performances. Got it.
Opera performances. He created his own version of the Palace of Versailles. Only he built his on an island in the middle of a lake, so he could...
That's how I'm going to do mine, too.
That's right, right. I know. So he could have privacy, and he even had a replica of the famous Hall of Mirrors.
Holy cow, he did it up.
But the most famous of his castles... Neuschwanstein.
Is Hogwarts. Oh, sorry, what is it?
It's not Hogwarts.
What is it called?
Neuschwanstein.
Did you practice that?
I did.
Good girl.
Thank you. Thank you. But this is also known as the Disney Castle because it inspired Walt Disney to create the Sleeping Beauty Castle. And, I mean, come on. It's your ultimate cliff-top refuge if you're looking for one. That's the place to go.
And I am in the market.
And you are in the market. It, of course, also has a theater for opera. So he spared no expense, but the problem was not a shortage of ideas and imagination, but ultimately he did have a shortage of funds.
Oh.
That's right. So he literally spent everything he had to try to live out this fantasy that he had in his head.
Wow.
He eventually got so far into debt that it gave his political enemies a little bit of wiggle room there to take him down.
Wow.
So they started to create a long list of things that he did that they thought were crazy, including supporting the arts. Nuts, totally nuts. But based on this list, they had a doctor declare him insane. The doctor had never even examined him.
Wow.
But he was declared insane. They stripped him of his title. The authorities captured him and sent him off to get psychiatric treatment. And 3 days later, his body and the body of the chief psychiatrist were found floating in a lake.
When did this become a true crime podcast?
Sorry, there's so many side stories. Like, you could totally tell his story through so many different lenses.
Oh, my God.
We will never know the mystery of his death. It's very doubtful that it was an accident. It's more likely that he was a victim of, you know, an orchestrated coup or even a hate crime because, again, people were not happy with, like, how outwardly he lived his life.
I don't want to bust your what do you make of this, but has anybody made a book, a movie, a
not in a long time
about
it's primed
this
and
moment,
ready
this exact
not,
moment.
I don't know if they've done anything about this exact moment or not.
Hot spark.
If they have, it has not been for a long time. It is hot and ready for someone to dive into it.
That's fascinating.
So we'll never know for sure how he died, but we definitely know how he lived as a creative being and a patron of the arts. And all of that really got me thinking, like, he felt such a strong calling in his heart to support artists whose work truly moved his soul. He felt compelled to make sure that their work got seen and heard. It's possible that he was literally the savior of Wagner's career. Mm. And it's possible that without him, we wouldn't know Wagner's name. We wouldn't know his work. And that just makes me think about how many artists there are out there, either from history or living today, whose work just may not ever get seen because they don't have a Ludwig in their life. Yeah. And I'm not saying that we all need to, you know, have an artist move into your empty bedroom. But
we're not not saying
that.
I'm not saying that.
It's a possibility. But I think there's so many ways to be a patron, whether it is buying a subscription to a theater. It is, you know, all of our artist friends who have GoFundMe pages, chip in a little bit or just give them a little bit of encouragement.
Be somebody's Ludwig.
Yes, be someone's Ludwig.
I like that spark.
Support
yeah.
them. You never know just what a difference it might make. And if you're an artist, just hang on. Like, know that it is possible for things to change. Wagner wrote this in his autobiography. On the same day that I met Ludwig, I had received the most urgent warnings to never return to Vienna. But my life was to have no more of those alarms. I was never again to feel the weight of everyday hardship or of existence under the protection of my exalted friend. And he also said this: one supreme fact which I have discovered is that it is not willpower, but fantasy and imagination that creates. Imagination is the creative force. Imagination creates reality. King Ludwig certainly created his own reality through his imagination. Maybe it was a coping mechanism. Maybe it was his only source of joy. We don't know. But his imagination was strong enough to also create some of our reality. More than 150 years later, we're still listening to music, visiting castles, watching performances of genius artistic work, all thanks to him, the Mad King.
What a good spark.
He's rich with good information. Like, that was, talk about a top line. That was a fast, fast top line, but there's so much good stuff to get into.
So many good sparks in that, and so many things. I mean, in addition to the normal ones, like do the ring cycle, produce that, perform that, sing from that. There's just like sparks on sparks on sparks with this.
It's amazing. And Wagner wasn't the only person that he supported. He commissioned more than 200 operas, plays, ballets. He wanted to make sure the people of Bavaria saw the great, you know, Shakespeare and Ibsen and Mozart.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Amazing. Good spark. All right.
But you got Blackwell.
Here we go.
I'm excited.
Up. Okay. Here we go. So the sources for my spark today come from CBSNews.com, specifically an episode of 60 Minutes with reporting by Bob Simon, may he rest in power, a video from the study guide from Opera Theater St. Louis, a New York Times review by Charles Isherwood, an article by Annie Cohen on the website JTA.org, a YouTube video by Taylor Russell, Boozy.com, an article by Susan, I think it may be a different Boozy that you're thinking of. An article by Suzanne Katz in the Atlanta Jewish Times, vedemunderground.com, and an article by Alexander Lee on historytoday.com. And this, my friends, is my spark.
Woo!
When we were performing that opera, we forgot where we were. We forgot all of our troubles. Music was part of our resistance. So this is what Cams and I like to call a dark spark. If you're listening with young children, I encourage you to use your discretion. Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Ella, and she was born on June 30th, 1930, in a small town in what is now part of the Czech Republic, very close to Germany. And when she was little, she knew that her birthday, June 30th, was a special day because it was the last day of school before summer break. So all the kids loved it. Ella was the second daughter to Max and Marquita Stein and little sister to Ilona. They had a close-knit family, and Ella recalled having a lovely childhood. In the summer, they would pick mushrooms and blueberries. They would go to concerts. There was a lot of skiing in the winter. at that time, the Czech Republic was a democracy that didn't experience anti-Semitism. So when Hitler began his campaign against the Jews, Ella's father didn't suspect that their lives would be disrupted. When he would listen to Hitler speeches on the radio, Ella and her big sister would put their fingers in their little ears because it was loud and they knew it was bad. Mm. So when Ella was just 8 years old, townspeople came to the Steins' home. They painted Jews out on their front door and smashed all of the windows around the town. The date of that was November 9th, 1938, what would come to be known as the first night of Kristallnacht, or the night of broken glass. And shortly after that night, they never saw their father again. Here's the tissues.
How old was Ella?
She was around 8 years old at this time. She was 8 years old. So Ella was eventually relocated to Prague with her mother and her sister, and that's when they were required to wear Jewish stars on all the layers of their clothing. And her school friends who were not Jewish stopped talking to them and playing with them. Mm-hmm. And she said sometimes the Jewish kids would play at the Jewish cemetery because they knew for sure other Jewish kids would be there and they'd have people to play with. So at the age of 11, 3 years later, 11 years old, Ella, her mother, and her sister were sent to Theresienstadt, which is a transit camp run by the Nazis. And she remembers being expelled from the transport train, forced to march through the snow for miles, and finally reaching the town where she watched these huge wooden gates of Theresienstadt close behind her. Mm. And at 11 years old, she knew she was in prison. Mm. Mercifully, she was allowed to stay with her mother and her sister in the same barracks. But thousands of prisoners were forced to live in these tight quarters. They were crammed into rooms and halls and stairwells of buildings. There wasn't enough to eat. But fortunately, Ella's mother worked in the guards' garden. Mm-hmm. And Ella proudly recalls that her mother was the best thief in Terezin. Her mother, Markita, would exchange these stolen vegetables for bits of food and bread and sugar for her daughters. So Terezin, a little history about Terezin, it had been a military fortress built in the 1780s by the Austrian Empire. And it was abandoned by the old ruling military. So the fortress Terezin became the town Terezin with a population of about 7,000. And in June of 1940, the Nazis took control of Terezin, expelled its non-Jewish residents, renamed it Theresienstadt, and began promoting it as a model Jewish settlement to the outside world. While in reality, it served as a transit camp for those being transported to Auschwitz and other concentration camps. So Theresienstadt had a few nicknames, depending on your ideology. Some called it the Führer's gift to the Jews, but others called it the waiting room for Auschwitz. Oh. It was open for 3.5 years. Nearly 140,000 Jews from all over Central Europe passed through on their way to other camps. And while they were not gassed at Theresienstadt, more than 30,000 people died because of disease and hunger. So there, despite these terrible living conditions and the constant threat that you were going to be deported out to one of the death camps, Theresienstadt had this very highly developed cultural life. Outstanding, prominent Jewish artists, mainly from Czechoslovakia, Austria, and Germany, created clandestine drawings and paintings and left a record of what it was like to live there. In addition, writers, professors, musicians, and actors would give lectures and concerts and theater performances, and they had a lending library of 60,000 volumes that people had brought with them, smuggled in. And maybe some that were left over from when it was a town. So because there were many musicians and artists in Terezin, music flourished in the camp. And one piece that I saw compared it to a Juilliard for Jews. Wow. There were classes and concerts in cellars and attics, and much of it had to be done in secret. In addition to all of these brilliant adults, 15,000 children passed through Theresienstadt. And all these kids needed something to do when the adults were sent away to work every day. Mm-hmm. And although they were forbidden to do so, they sort of attended these makeshift schools in secret to maintain a vestige of normalcy. And in these schools, they would sing and they'd play and they painted pictures. And if they had a little pencil or a little piece of paper, they would write little poems. They also decided to open a children's home, and Ella moved there. And she was under the care of this young piano teacher. So around that same time, in July of 1943, a man named Rudolf Freudenfeld smuggled in to Theresienstadt. He smuggled in the piano score of a children's opera named Brundibar. He asked if it was possible for the children of Theresien to sing in the opera. So they were already singing in their rooms and in their makeshift schools. So one of the caretakers, this young piano teacher, sent them to audition for Brundibar. And one of the people that auditioned was Ella. And she was really nervous. And she wondered, oh, who's going to get a part? And they went in and they had their little audition and they sang the scale. And Ella was cast in the role of the cat. She had no idea what opera would feature a cat. But when she saw her mom, she was allowed to visit her mom for about an hour every second day. She saw her mom and she told her mom, "Mom, I'm singing in a children's opera and I be the cat." Oh. And her mom looked at her and said, "Wagner never had a cat in the opera." But Ella knew that her mom was very happy.
Singing seems like a very difficult thing to stay hidden in, the tension, the danger.
I think
singing.
You're right. I think there was a lot of just sort of overlooking, you know, sometimes the rules were very strictly enforced and sometimes less so. Mm. This is the poster for the opera. Oh. Brundibar. So Brundibar is a children's opera. The music is by Hans Krause and the libretto is by Adolf Hofmeister. Hans Krause was born in the city of Prague in 1899. He began composing music as a child and had his first piece publicly performed when he was 11. He learned violin and piano as a child and later studied composition in Berlin and Paris. Brundibar was created as a submission for a children's opera competition in 1938, and as Czechoslovakia awaited its imminent invasion by Germany, the whole music competition got shut down, so no winner was announced, no prize money was awarded. And then the composer, Krause, was arrested, and he was soon transported to Theresienstadt. Krause was appointed head of musical activities for the camp, and using that smuggled piano reduction of the Brundibar score and his memory, he reorchestrated the opera using the instruments that were available.
Wow.
Yeah. So this children's opera, Brundibar, is a fantasy story about these two little kids. Their mom is sick, and they try to earn money to buy her milk to make her well by singing in the marketplace. But they keep getting drowned out by this evil, mustachioed organ grinder named Brundibar. And he's got this mechanical organ, and all he has to do is turn the crank on his organ. But the kids have real musical skill, but it takes all of the children in the town singing together with their voices rising up and the help of a magical cat, dog, and bird to make this work of art that earns them the money that they need to make their mother healthy. And in the end, the foe is sent packing and everybody sings a victory song. Mm. So many concerts, plays, and lectures were allowed at Theresienstadt, and then they were taken away as punishment. So I know. So the cast of Brundibar is rehearsing this. They get cast. They're excited. They're rehearsing it, but they don't know if it's going to get taken away, if it would ever be presented. But on September 23rd, 1943, Brundibar was performed in front of an audience of Jews and watchful Nazi guards. And here is a photo. Aww. That's the cast of Brundibar. And this is Ella. As the cat, her costume was her sister's ski pants and her mother's sweater, and the director had smuggled in, had the foresight to smuggle in a little stage makeup. So you'll see she has little whiskers and she has her little feet, bare feet, sort of blacked to play the little black cat. It was received with deafening applause because many in the audience knew that the cruel organ grinder, Brundibar, represented Hitler, and the opera was playing out his defeat. Mm. And the opera was presented every week thereafter. Dita Kraus, who was in the ensemble of Brundibar, remembers that tickets were printed for every performance, and it was not easy to get in. Totally standing room only. But the most special part was that when they performed... The most special part was that when they performed, they didn't have to wear the Jewish star.
Oh.
They felt like they were really special. And Ella said that for those children,
Brenda Barr was their entire lives and that she would never forget it. So Eva Gross, who was 20 at the time and taught the children, said, "All I can hear and see is Ella never stopping singing the cat." So we all sang the cat in the end, because you know when kids are in like the school play and they won't stop doing their parts, she would never stop. She just lived for it. So they all knew the part of the cat. The lead role, the part of Brundabar, was played by a boy named Hansa Treichlinger. One article said that Hansa seemed to know instinctively how to make the villain human by twitching his false mustache so skillfully with such impeccable timing that he might have been on the stage his whole life. And Ella said everybody loved him. Everybody just adored him. There he is. Sorry, there he is. The whole town was mesmerized by the opera, the story of this evil man with a mustache. But they wondered, did the kids really have any idea what the opera was really about? And their teacher, Eva Gross, has said in interviews, yes, they knew. Oh. They knew exactly the symbolic meaning. Oh, yeah. Yes, they knew. Honda Drury, who as a little girl once got a chance to play the role of the dog, said, "It was our way to fight the evil." For the children on stage, Brundabar was a way for them to act out and defeat Hitler over and over and over again. It was like their secret act of resistance. And the teacher, Eva Gross, said, "It was very liberating." And of course, not only the whole room, the whole house, the whole town sang the victory song afterwards. Asked if the Germans didn't realize what was going on, Hondra Drury said, "Yeah, we wondered that all the time, if they don't understand what we're singing is against them or if they just don't care, because they knew what we didn't know, that we were all meant to go to the gas chambers." So indeed, rehearsals and performances were continuously disrupted by the deportation of cast members to the extermination camps. And then those players would be replaced by newly arriving children. Brundabar would be performed 55 times through the following year, and at every single performance, Ella continued to play the cat. So these Nazis, as you know, were masters of propaganda, and they promoted Theresienstadt as a model camp to hide their deportations and the exterminations of Europe's Jewish population. And in their propaganda, Theresienstadt was described as a spa town, where elderly German Jews could retire in safety, and it was all part of this strategy of deception. In June of 1944, succumbing to pressures, the Germans permitted the International Red Cross to visit, and in an elaborate hoax, the SS decided to deceive the delegation into believing that it actually was a self-administered Jewish settlement. So shortly before their visit, they concocted this unbelievable piece of theater. They deported 7,500 Jews so that Theresienstadt wouldn't look overcrowded. They beautified the ghetto. They planted flowers and gardens. They painted houses. They renovated the barracks. They built a kindergarten. They opened coffee shops and stores, and they put a bandstand in the town square. And on June 23rd, 1944, the Red Cross delegates came for their one-day visit, and this whole, it's like curtain up. One survivor reported that the Nazis selected the people, like they cast the people to sit in the cafe in the town. This is like a fucking movie to me. I can't believe it. They selected the people to sit there in the town square, to drink coffee, to listen to music. They would select these young, pretty women to sit there, and they made Terezin look like this beautiful, quaint, charming little place for one day.
This makes me angry.
I know.
Feeling so many feelings.
I know. It makes my blood boil, but it makes me spark too.
Yes,
like it's a lot. So they also staged social and cultural events for visiting dignitaries, and they decided that a performance of Brundabar would be the centerpiece. So a special performance of the opera was given, utilizing improved sets and costumes. And this young boy, Paul Sanfort, was in the orchestra that day, and he played the trumpet. And that little boy in the little vest is Paul. And he said that performance was more tense because you had this feeling of you must not fail. You must play for your life. So the Red Cross delegates went exactly where the Nazis took them. They didn't question the prisoners. In fact, the Swiss head of delegation took pictures like this one to show how happy the children looked. And the deception worked. In the final report of the Red Cross delegation, it read that Theresienstadt looks like a normal provincial town where the elegantly dressed women all had silk stockings, scarves, and stylish handbags. Yeah. They also wrote that Theresienstadt is a final destination camp and that people who come there are not sent elsewhere. But in fact, by the time of their visit, 68,000 people had already been shipped from there to death camps. Our little trumpeter, Paul Sanfort, acknowledged the Nazis did convince the world, but they only convinced the world because the world wanted to be convinced. It was easier. So when the performance for the Red Cross was over, the transports to Auschwitz were accelerated. Those who stayed behind, like Ella, watched as their friends and fellow cast members were herded into the trains. And for those who stayed in Theresienstadt, it meant learning new parts all the time, which wasn't a problem because everyone knew the opera by heart. But by the end of 1944, performances stopped abruptly because there was hardly anyone left. Like very few other cast members of Brundibar, Dita Kraus survived, but she lost her entire family and almost all of her friends. She said so few of them survived. And they were so talented, so many wonderful children among them, and promising children. That's the pity of it. Children that would have become poets and artists, and so many of them. And they are all gone for nothing. Of the children who passed through Theresienstadt, approximately 90% eventually perished. Only 132 survived. Ella's co-star, Holnze Treichlinger, the young boy who played Brundibar, was sent to the gas chambers in 1944. The same year, Brundibar composer Hans Krause was deported to the concentration camp Auschwitz, where he was immediately executed. Paul Sanfort, our trumpet player, survived the Holocaust, and he lived to be 77. In the last years of his life, he composed an overture to Brundibar because it had never had one. And his piece, Nachschub, written for speaker and musical ensemble based on his own text, expresses the thoughts of a hungry child queuing up for food in the Theresienstadt camp. On May 3rd, 1945, Theresienstadt was turned over to the International Red Cross and again became Theresien. Ella had spent 3.5 years at the camp and was almost 15 when she was freed. After the liberation, they returned to Prague, but Ella eventually moved to Israel, where she served in the army and in Israel's equivalent of the Secret Service. In Israel, she met her husband, Leopold, and eventually they moved to New York with their children. The bonds of friendship and survival she formed stayed with Ella her entire life. Throughout her life, she searched for her remaining girlhood friends. And in 1986, Ella and her friends reunited in Prague, and they agreed to meet at least once every year. And they kept their promise until Ella was the last surviving cast member of Theresien's Brundibar. And there they are.
Oh.
Brundibar, the children's opera, also survived the Holocaust and is now performed to memorialize the children who were murdered. And Ella became its most loyal champion, spending much of the rest of her life traveling the world to attend every production of Brundibar that she could, where she spoke with children and told them about her time at Theresien, the Holocaust, and Brundibar. And there she is. She felt it was her duty as a free survivor to share the background of Brundibar, and as long as she could speak to children, she could let them know what it meant and that there is always hope. Ella passed away on March 30th, 2018. Her life was a defiant message of hope amid destruction. She always loved music and thought it could not only elevate regular life, but also represent political resistance. So, what do we make of it? And what have people made of it? In 2008, Ella Weisberger released the children's book, The Cat with the Yellow Star, Coming of Age in Theresien, co-written with Susan Goldman Rubin. Tony Kushner, who wrote Angels in America, and Maurice Sendak, who wrote Where the Wild Things Are, teamed up to produce an illustrated children's book of Brundibar. And they also created a new English libretto for Brenda Barr, and Sendak co-designed the production. Ella Weisberger once said, "We performed this opera at Terezin. Only a few of us survived. I lost many of my friends. But when we were performing Brenda Barr, we forgot where we were. We forgot all of our troubles. Music was part of our resistance against the Nazis. Music, art, good teachers, and friends mean survival. I am so sparked by the spark. I know it is a dark spark, but the power of art to restore dignity and hope, and the power of music to bolster the human spirit.
That's right.
I am sparked by that. I am sparked as a creative activist. And I have to say, I'm also sparked by the kindness of Ella Weisberger. Like, by all accounts, the people that she spoke with and taught, her students, she was just love and kindness personified after having been through so much.
All of that.
So I'm so sparked by her way of being. So full of love, so full of goodness. So that is my spark. That is Brenda Barr. And now,
Susan,
the tissues.
Blackwell. It's painful to hear that story, but I love the takeaway from it, the meaning behind all of that, to acknowledge the power of art, the power of these stories that we put together and telling them, and what it means to each person who's involved.
We talk about this all the time on the podcast and in life and in private, but life is, life is a mixed bag of nuts, right? Mm. And sometimes it is awesome, and sometimes it is nawsome, which is the opposite of awesome. And if we are to live through these experiences, at the very least, one possibility is that we get to make something beautiful out of it. Mm-hmm. We get to make something beautiful out of this. And Camion, I cannot wait. This is just like you were saying about Ludwig, and this is just like the highest level. There are so many sparks in this.
That's right.
And I feel like this could spark music. This could spark choreography. Mm-hmm. This could spark certainly literature, like documentary, just like sparks
when
on sparks.
When I think about, like, you had asked the question of, do the children know, what it all represents? Then you talked about the performance where they, sort of like extra loaded, because now we're doing the performance to pretend, to sell an idea.
Yeah.
I wondered if they knew really what was going on in that moment. You said it was extra tense, but
I think they really knew.
The pain of having to perform something to convince people of something.
That you're okay.
I can't with that. That's, like, to me, that moment is so rich with emotion and layers.
There's an interesting spark, because they talked about how the Red Cross delegation, I think they only sent like two people to cover mm-hmm. the whole grounds. And they said they attempted to talk to one person who was in prison there who would not speak. And they talked to the mayor. I'm using quotes if you're mm-hmm. listening on the podcast. They talked to the mayor, who had a black eye. Mm. So they were clearly just like terrified and coerced. Ugh. It's very dramatic. Like, it is, it's very fraught. But I can really, when I was reading this and researching this, I could just picture a lot of art and work that will hopefully be continued to be made out
inspired
of it.
Inspired by this. Yeah.
But we have to set this dark spark to the side.
We do. I just have to acknowledge, like, Wagner's family went on to invite Hitler to the theater, to the opera house, the festival house. They, his
Are you
children
kidding?
Became members of the Nazi party. I'm not kidding.
Oh, no.
I just didn't want that to go by, if there are people who, know, like, more about Wagner and then your story. And we surprise each other with our sparks, so we don't know. So this is really amazing at how many places where our themes have touched upon the world of nationalism and Nazis.
Wow. We've brought the room down. Let's bring it back
Let's
up.
Let's bring it back up.
Let's bring the room back up.
We have someone here who could help us bring it back up.
I think we do. I had put it on his shoulders, but we're going to do it. Our guest is a full-on star here at the Metropolitan Opera, where audiences can hear him sing the titular role in the opera Akhenaten through December 7th and on November 23rd, live in HD at a movie theater near you.
Won't you all give it up? The warmest Sparkfile welcome for Anthony Roth Costanzo.
A.R.C. A.R.C.
It's like a game show when you come down the stairs. If they call your name and then you have to come downstairs, it's like Price is Right.
Prizes.
Price is Right.
We are so happy that you are joining us on the Sparkfile.
Thank you for having me.
But before we kick it off,
we have a little price of admission. Real quick, you have to tell us a creative risk that you have taken recently, something that required bravery or something that you attempted but wasn't perfect, but it was progress.
That's a really great question. There are lots of things coming to mind. Some of them we'll talk about later.
Okay.
But one recently, I was asked by Opera Philadelphia to do a cabaret. And, you know, when I was a kid, I was on Broadway. I moved from North Carolina, where I grew up, to New York to be on Broadway. So it's somewhere in my bones.
Mm-hmm. What was the Broadway show you were doing?
Well, I did a bunch of things. I did the National Tour of Falsettos, Sound of Music with Marie Osmond, the Christmas Carol with Ben Vereen.
Okay, now back to your wrist.
So, yeah. I was on this stage, and I thought, what can I do that will sort of link the cabaret music and the opera music? And I had this idea to make my debut as a baritone, because I'm a countertenor and I sing in this very high voice, but I also could sing, and I do really badly, as a baritone.
Wow. That's risky. That's brave and exciting.
And so I wound up doing a duet from The Marriage of Figaro, in which the Count and Susanna sing in alternation, but never really together. So I sang both. I got a standing ovation.
Who recorded it? Where could is there anywhere someone could hear that?
I have to say, strangely enough, you were saying a risk that paid off or didn't.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, is that going to work? But I just got a call last week, and apparently the Guggenheim Museum was at this performance, and they've asked me to come do it at the Guggenheim in January.
I'd say it paid off.
Yeah, I guess it worked. I got to do it again, which I'm sort of scared about.
Wow.
Risk part two. Yeah.
You are officially admitted to the Sparkfile.
Welcome.
Anthony, for people who don't know you, how do you identify creatively?
I would say that I am an opera singer, and contained within that, very importantly, is an actor, because that's at the base of all opera singing.
Sure.
And a producer, because now I've started producing a lot of things and making things happen. So that's what I would say.
This is fantastic.
Thanks. Wow. You're like a vocal superhero.
Don't be bashful.
Could you tell us a little bit about your superhero origin story? When did you realize you could sing?
I was about 6 years old, taking piano lessons with my piano teacher, and she was trying to get me to read the music, and I was not doing so well with my fingers. So she said, let's try doing it with your voice. Mm. And then I loved singing. And then she suggested we sing some Gershwin. I sang some Gershwin, and I loved that. And then I went and did an audition for a play, and that's what got it all started. And I was a boy soprano, but when I was about 11, I'd done 10 or 15 plays locally, and I said to my parents, look, I gotta go to New York and I gotta do it for real.
Wow. And they how old?
And I was 11.
And your parents were like, yeah, sure, sounds good.
They're both psychologists, so I got really lucky.
To meet your parents. Let's have your parents on the podcast.
Yeah, they're
too.
Great.
I
they're really
want to know more.
They're very understated, and they just said okay. And so I went, and I was doing Broadway and plays and things like that. And then when I was 13, someone said, would you come do an opera? And I'd never done an opera, but it was Benjamin Britten's The Turn of the Screw. Very difficult.
Spooky.
And also
just in time for Halloween.
Yeah, indeed. Ghosts and and importantly, child abuse. And I say that, I know that sounds wrong. It sounds wrong. But I say that because my parents, who were both psychologists, would take me out to rehearsals. And they were in New Jersey. We were at the New Jersey Opera Festival. And we would talk. And all of a sudden, I was doing a thing that was about what they studied. You know, they studied post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma and all this.
Just bringing the whole family together.
Well, yeah, around, you know. But but it was really interesting because it connected all of us and it engaged me in an intellectual way because they were both professors in this art form. And then I found a way of expressing myself in opera that was much deeper than what I had been able to find in musical theater. This is not to knock musical theater at all. I love
That's
it.
That's okay.
But,
okay.
you know, it's a different kind of expression. And so I loved that. And that got me started on opera. And when I was doing that, someone said, hey, I think you've gone through puberty. Are you maybe a countertenor? And I said, what is a countertenor?
New phone, who does?
And they said, it's a guy who sings in that high register, and you just keep going. And so I just kept going, and I haven't turned back yet.
Was there a moment that you were cognizant of that preference towards opera? Or did it sort of flow naturally towards that, or did you?
Well, I would say after I did The Turn of the Screw, I got a call to perform as the shepherd boy in Tosca, starring Luciano Pavarotti. Wow. And so I then, went into this opera house. And I remember being in my little shepherd boy costume behind the curtain at the end of the opera, and Pavarotti was in charge, and he was sending people out, one, two, three, no, you go now, you go, you know, none of the bells were choreographed. And then it was just me and him, and he didn't look at me, and I thought, I'm probably not going to get a bow because, you know.
Sure.
And then he put his hand out, and he took me out with him for his bow.
Oh.
Now, that was very smart because the audience went wild. You know, Pavarotti and a kid. He knew what he was doing. But I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, you get this ovation, and you're at the opera house with Pavarotti. And I thought, I like opera.
I think I could do this. Yeah, feels pretty good.
Good, yeah. So that's great.
How's your voice today? Would you be willing, for people who are listening who don't know what countertenor means, just like give us a tiny taste?
Sure. I just came from a Sitzprobe, which means sit and try in German. Yes. And we sat and we sure tried. But it's a rehearsal with the orchestra. Anyway, I speak in my chest voice, but the head voice, which is like a falsetto.
Oh, he's backing up, ladies.
Back away from the microphone.
You know, mic technique is like, so that's the range that I sing in generally.
I am literally feeling you.
Oh, good.
Literally.
The vibrations were amazing.
So you're starring in the Philip Glass opera Akhenaten on stage at the Metropolitan Opera. That is so fancy. But real quick, just real quick, can you just tell me everything we need to know about Akhenaten so that we can see it?
Well, what's exciting for me and for students, there's this fascination with ancient Egypt, and it's all curricular for us, you know, at some point in middle school, even into high school. And I'd never gotten the Egypt bug until we started this production, and now I'm totally obsessed because there's so much interesting material, and there are so many ways to relate it to our contemporary world. Mm-hmm. So basically, we're in 1352 to 1325 BC, something like that, and this is the Amarna period, which was Akhenaten's period. And just to give you context, this is 3,000 years ago, 200 years before Moses, so a long, long time ago. And you have all of this Egyptian society for hundreds of years has been the same with many, many gods. Mm-hmm. And Akhenaten becomes pharaoh and shortly thereafter says, you know what? I'm looking at the sun and I think that God is the sun, which gives life to the grass, and grass gives life to the cattle, and cattle give life to us. So this is the source of all life, and that should be God. And that God is the unification of man and woman. And it dictates how we should be represented in art, more realistically, not as these stick figures, but with all the curves that we have, that man and woman should be represented in art on equal footing with their family on their laps, as opposed to this more formal way of representing nobility. And he also built a new city. He united Upper and Lower Egypt, brought them together in a city that was called Amarna, and a new palace. And this happened in an unprecedented amount of time, by which I mean very, very fast. Mm. And so he changed the way that writing was done. It was done in clay with little sticks. You would make carvings, but he changed the method by which it was done. He changed so much of society in these 17 years and was, by our modern words and lenses, progressive.
Yeah.
And then, after 17 years, we don't know what happens. Oh. All we know is that he disappears.
Oh, no.
And that every statue of him is destroyed, every painting of him is torn up, and every trace that he's left behind is erased, and what he has created is reversed. So there were clearly people who didn't want this. One example of these people would be there were certain priests who were paid to make sacrifices to the hundreds and hundreds of gods by the nobility. Now, when those hundreds of gods are less important because of this new god,
that's right.
They don't get their money.
They're not psyched about that.
Yeah.
Oh,
so it changes how society and the caste system that was there works. Mm-hmm. So there were certainly people who were opposed to it, but Akhenaten also might have been kind of insular, focused on the family, focused on what he was creating in Egypt. And he might have been seen not as such a progressive in a positive sense, but as a kind of cult leader who created this new religion, who tore everyone from what they knew and said, do it my way. So one question this opera asks and doesn't necessarily answer, but you have to answer, is, was Akhenaten good or bad? Very simple. Was he the visionary, the person who solved these problems, who was creating a way forward for society, or was he this horrible dictator? And what's interesting, what's as interesting as the primary source material that is in the opera, the fragments of history that are connected by Philip Glass's music, is all of the interpretations subsequently when Akhenaten was discovered in the 19th century that people like Freud write a book called Moses and Monotheism, where he posits that Akhenaten and the loss of Akhenaten is what inspired Moses to create his monotheistic religion, and therefore the genesis of Christianity, Judaism, and the Islamic faith all come from Akhenaten.
Whoa.
And was Akhenaten the original father who we lost and we search for? And is the search for the father the basis of Western religion? And is it the basis of human psychology in some sense, this Oedipal thing? So Akhenaten has a lot projected
on him. It has a lot of questions.
Akhenaten's got a lot going on. You're smart.
But to also...
Susan's struggling with this. Let's give her a second.
No, but to connect to your earlier spark... You know, the Nazis were also into this sun worship, so they appropriated Akhenaten.
It's a web of sparks.
And they tried to prove that Akhenaten had Aryan origins.
It down.
And isn't it interesting that Akhenaten gave his speeches from the Window of Appearances, which is actually a scene in the opera, which was the second level balcony of the palace. And there we find Hitler giving his speeches from the balcony.
Wow.
So it's rather chilling to think of the different people. Akhenaten also seeing God as the unification of man and woman is represented in a lot of art with what we see as breasts and hips and full lips. So people thought he was a hermaphrodite. But when I was talking to some Egyptologists in Oxford and said, was he really?
Sure you were.
Oxford. We knew Oxford was involved.
And they said, well, you know, if he saw God as the unification of man and woman and he was trying to make himself closer to God, maybe he just became more like a woman. And I said, so he was trans. And they said, yeah, that's what we would call it today. He took on these attributes of a woman to be closer to his God. So now, as part of the queer community, can we appropriate him in that? So all of the interpretations of Akhenaten are as interesting as the primary source material.
Oh, my God.
And this that's why he's referred to as the first individual. The first person to have these singular ideas and to inspire our culture.
Can we ask you a little bit about how it feels, the performance-wise, for you? We know what it looks like on the outside. It is literally gold-leafed. It's dazzling. It's glorious. Can you tell us, for reals, though, how does it feel on the inside to get to play this character?
Well, I think it is really interesting, again, from a psychological point of view and as an actor, which is at the base of all singing and really has to to drive the notes as they come out of your body. What did he feel? That's what I have to think about. I have to understand the context in which he existed and what everyone thought about him. But then what did he feel? Why did he have this idea? And that's what I think about as I get put into these crowns and these robes, and I'm moving very, very slowly with very repetitive music by Philip Glass, which is incredibly beautiful, but needs to be charged with meaning.
I just interrupt. Sometimes very slowly, yes, and sometimes super nakedly.
Super naked, yes. I enter naked, slowly. Completely waxed and my head shaved and totally naked. And there's been a lot of discussion about this.
I bet.
Why is he naked?
I bet.
Well, one thing is it's not at all sexualized, but rather it's a part of a ritual which comes from the Book of the Dead. And as such, if you can imagine this, I enter the stage, and this really connects to what you're saying about what's in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to let all artifice go. If there's even any tension in my body when I appear completely naked, the audience is nervous and looking at each other. If I can look them in the eye, completely released, completely with conviction, they can't breathe. And from that moment, it's like a pact with the audience that we are going to have this artistic journey together. And you wouldn't believe it because it's never happened, especially at a place like the Met before. I don't think ever full frontal nudity for a male has happened, especially on this scale, but I don't think ever.
Rock on you and rock on Met.
Yes.
I should say this, though. Yes. I don't think that the nudity is actually going to
be on the
Met
HD,
and HD Live.
Won't be visible. And it's also, it's a way of creating this pact of trust with the audience. And what you'll realize is it becomes such a ritual and such a part of a stage picture that it doesn't change things. But to answer your question, as I go through that, I'm incredibly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And that vulnerability of a 17-year-old boy taking over a whole country.
Right.
And then a few years later, changing everything about that country is kind of remarkable to see him go both from a young male naked body into a pharaoh with robes who controls a whole country, and then later in the opera into a woman. We see breasts come into, we see the body change.
Wow.
We see him take on these feminine attributes throughout the course of the opera. So we see all of these transformations.
Can I just touch on one thing? You spoke about a moment where you're aware that you're causing the audience to not be able to breathe. That to me, and then you described it as vulnerable, and I was just like, wow, I guess the paradox in that is that when you described it, I thought that must be so powerful to know that everyone is literally breathless.
That's a really interesting point, and I think that there's a certain power to the connection.
Yeah.
But rather than me asserting my will over the audience, it's me feeling their energy and trying to meet it. Because I want the audience to come to me. I don't want them to sit back in their chair and go, oh, I am receiving a performance. They actually have to participate in it. And they have to participate with their breath, with their energy. And I don't want to sound like some, you know, crazy healer or voodoo person.
But it
is true that the magic of the theater and the texture of the air in the live theater is unlike anything we get from watching a screen. Yeah. And that is because there is this connection. And every moment that I'm on stage, I'm trying to find a way to connect with at least one person in that audience, even if someone else has tuned out or fallen asleep, which is great. We all come in and out of that. And in fact, I have a good friend who is new to the opera and said to me, one of my favorite parts of going to the opera is the moment when I wake up and I realize I'm at the opera. This is amazing.
Oh, I love you.
Is there anything creative that you know that you need to do before you're done?
In life?
In life, personally, yeah.
Well, that's a great question. Certainly, I feel that this creative art form of opera, why are we spending so much money and so much time and so much effort doing it? And I think about that a lot. Mm-hmm. Then I go into a school in the Bronx with kids, and I work with these middle schoolers, and I don't say to them, okay, so I want you to know the story, and I want you to know the words, and I want you to understand what a countertenor is. Instead, I just say, what emotions have you been dealing with lately? And we talk Ooh. About that. And then if they say they're sad, we talk about some reasons they're sad. Amazing things come out. And then I say, okay, now I'm going to sing an aria that's about sadness. That's all you need to know. Maybe in a different language. I may be singing like a girl. Mm. It doesn't really matter. And I start singing, and they all start laughing, and they all start, you know, going, oh, it's too loud. And then about 2 minutes in, they quiet down. Mm. And about 3 minutes in, I see tears. And then I think, if these people who have never heard opera before and who have no point of access other than mm-hmm. this one little thing we've given them, have that connection to the primal thing, which is the human voice, it's important. And we're living in a world in which there is no empathy. You know, we are not understanding the plight of others in the way that we should. And mm-hmm. so when we see stories that allow us to feel empathy for good people, for bad people, to think about these big issues that we don't encounter enough in our lives. We read constant news stories and they go right past us. If we can use opera as a way to see these things with a little bit of distance, but also with beauty, then it changes how we interact with the world. So I think that's important. So what do I need to do in my life before I'm done? I need to bring new audiences to this art form. Can I do that as a performer? Yes. Can I do that as a producer?
Yes.
As someone who runs things, as someone who educates? Sure. So my goal and my mission has been to create projects in all different ways, sometimes as an educator, sometimes as an innovator, working with fashion designers, working with filmmakers, working with opera directors, working with kids. And how can we get these people interested and excited about this art form, which ultimately can help make the world a better place?
Mm. I love that. Thank you, Grace. Yes.
Can you tell us something, a person or thing or an idea that is sparking you lately?
That's a good question. What's an idea that is sparking me lately? So this spring, a movie came out of Aretha Franklin making her sixth album, I think, Grace. Now, Aretha had been at the top of her game, you know, Respect, all of that had come out. And then she decided she was going to record gospel music, and she was going to do it in a church for her community. And Sidney Pollack was going to film just, you know, from the side with his little camera. And they lost all the film, and it got all messed up until...
They found it.
They found it. And it came out, and it's called Amazing Grace.
Oh, wow.
Sparks, yes, sparks.
That is good.
And you watch her, and what she does is the work, as we call it.
The work.
She's not there to perform. She's not there to, you know, to show anything. She's there, and she's with her community, and she's with this incredible gospel choir and these incredible gospel leaders, and it's all shared. And you realize that it's lovely when people say you're a star, but really, we're a community of people doing this, and that's what's so wonderful about opera. I can't do it without everybody. No. And it's not my performance, it's our collective performance. I look at the conductor, I look at my castmates, I see the bows of the orchestra, poking their way into my line of vision. And I know that it's with just my voice, it's nothing. So that was really inspiring for me to see that.
I love it, and I love you. Special thanks to our very special guest, Anthony Rob Costanzo.
Thank you.
We want to thank everyone here at the Met: Peter Gelb, Jillian Brearley, Will Berger, Marcia Drummond, Dan Marshall, Kamala Schelling,
That is it. We hope this put another bunch of sparks in your file. And remember, if there's a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and you fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that, or if you'd like us to come rock the Spark File podcast or workshop at your institution of culture, learning, or business, give us a holler. You can email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website. That's right. These fools got a website. It's thesparkfile.com.
We'll even take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you've taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, share it with people you love. If you don't like it, it's okay. We're just going to keep doing our thing and shake, shake, shake in our creative booty.
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You got to conceive it. You got to believe it. You got to talk, sing like a boss and recitative it.
You got to take it
and make it.
Inspires me. I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.
Hi friends, it's Susan Blackwell from The Spark File, your one-stop shop for creativity where our doors are open. And if you smell something delicious, that's because Laura Camion and I have been cooking up something special, something designed to make a big difference in people's creative lives. Enter The Brave Creative, a free 5-day guided adventure to rediscover the vitality, energy, and possibility in your creative process. Whether you're a writer, a performer, a baker, a candlestick maker, navigating the creative process can be a bear. But never fear, there's power in numbers at the Spark File. So let's link arms and make the trip together. It's May 13th through 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern, less than 1 hour per day. And if you can't join live, don't worry about it. You can watch the replay. Join us by going to thesparkfile.com to register. And hey, if you're not familiar with The Spark File, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Secondly, we work with hundreds of creatives of all different kinds who are ready to take their next big step. We help folks fear less and create more in a community that is so fun and vibrant. And if you have joined us before, know that we are going deep with The Brave Creative. So buckle up, Buttercup. It is going to be an awesome adventure. Go to thesparkfile.com to register, but do it soon because it all starts May 13th. Thesparkfile.com. Register now.